All right, everyone, it's the takeaway for May 30th. I'm Tanzina Vega.
We have to determine whether the impeachment process would be more of an illuminating and unifying experience for the public.
Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin continues to push for impeachment after Robert Mueller speaks for the first time.
I hesitate to say that even a majority of the House has still read the report, much less the majority of the American people. So you see, we're going through waves of public education about what's in there.
We also break down the reaction to Mueller's statement across Washington.
Republicans, they're saying case closed. They say this is something to put behind Congress. But for Democrats, the momentum goes the other way.
Plus, a new documentary explores the lives of three Puerto Rican women who fled to New York after Hurricane Maria.
Right now, there's over 2 million more Puerto Ricans living in the United States. So therefore, the experience of diaspora or displacement from Puerto Rico to the United States is a constitutive part of being Puerto Rican.
Here we go, everyone. Let's get to it. When Robert Mueller spoke publicly for the first and last time as special counsel, he declined to clear the president of wrongdoing. Instead, he reiterated the Justice Department's opinion that it would be unconstitutional to charge a sitting president with a crime.
The opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing.
A process other than the criminal justice system. Well, that could mean impeachment. But while more House Democrats are calling to move forward with what the president calls the I word, 45% of Americans said they support impeaching the president. But party leadership, however, is still holding off. Joining me now is someone who would be directly involved in those impeachment proceedings. Congressman Jamie Raskin is a Democrat who serves Maryland's 8th District in the House of Representatives, and he's also on the House Judiciary Committee. Congressman Raskin, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So, Congressman, you've already called to start impeachment inquiries. Did Robert Mueller's statement yesterday change anything for those in the Democratic Party who are still on the fence?
Well, I think it did. You know, those people who have been calling for the launching of an impeachment inquiry are the people who've been most closely involved in this process over the last several months, the members of the Judiciary Committee, the members of the Oversight Committee. What Mueller did yesterday was to contradict Attorney General Barr on a number of critical points. The first thing that he did was to point out that the reason that Donald Trump was not indicted by Special Counsel Mueller was because of the DOJ rule forbidding the indictment of a sitting president. It was not for a want of evidence. And he was very emphatic and clear about that. He wanted no further confusion about it. He also rejected, in one sentence, Attorney General Barr's 19-page single-space memorandum, which basically said that the president could never be guilty of obstructing justice because he sits on top of the law enforcement machinery. And Attorney General Barr said that that's absolutely wrong, because when a subject interferes in an investigation into himself, that is the cardinal meaning of obstruction of justice. And of course, nobody's above the law here. So I think that those points ramified in a very sharp way across certainly the Democratic caucus. I hope some Republicans absorbed and heard it. And of course, we wanted Mueller to come right away to speak to the public because we know not everybody had read the report and not everybody's going to read the report. But when he did, I think that it struck everybody with gale force.
Congressman, why is the Democratic leadership so split over whether or not to begin impeachment proceedings? Is it political?
You don't
see it that way, but there are lots of folks that do.
No, I know. And, you know, this sells whatever the cyber equivalent of newspapers is these days. I mean, to make it seem like there's a big division or polarization within the Democratic caucus. I think what you have, rather, is an evolving situation. This is a moving target. There's some of us who've been living and breathing this for the last several months. There are people like me on the Judiciary Committee who read the report within the first couple hours. I hesitate to say that even a majority of the House has still read the report, much less the majority of the American people. So you see, we're going through waves of public education about what's in there. Mueller talked about 11 different episodes of presidential obstruction of justice. That's very serious business, of course. And, you know, people, not everybody has a vivid sense of what's in there, but the evidence is quite overwhelming. And, of course, they've been involved in obstructing Congress ever since, because the president has ordered his subordinates not to participate in investigations, to defy subpoenas, not to turn over evidence, and so on.
Well, to that point, we did hear from Nancy Pelosi yesterday afternoon. She made remarks, and it didn't sound like she's in a different spot than she was before Mueller's remarks yesterday. Let's take a listen.
Maybe 38 of them out of 238 have said that they wanted to be outspoken on impeachment, and many of them are reflecting their views as well as those of their constituents. Many constituents want to impeach the president, but we want to do what is right and what gets results. What gets results?
Congressman, what gets results here?
Well, of course, legislatively, the speaker is properly focused on doing all those things that we got elected to work on. We want to lower prescription drug prices and passed an excellent bill on that last week. We want equal pay for equal work for women. We passed an excellent bill on that. We want to improve gun safety and close the gun show loophole. So we've passed all these bills that are just sitting over there in the Senate, the same kind of constitutional obstructionism we're seeing from the president, we're getting at the legislative side from Mitch McConnell. But look, I mean, here's the movement that's taking place. I think that over the last couple of weeks, you know, dozens of members of our caucus have come out for launching an impeachment inquiry. And I think that that's the key distinction that members are starting to focus on. There's a difference between an impeachment inquiry, which is just launching the investigation into high crimes and misdemeanors, versus articles of impeachment, which is the end of the process where you get what's effectively an indictment that's voted on and then sent over to the Senate for a trial. But most impeachment inquiries in the House of Representatives have not resulted in articles of impeachment. So I think that a lot of people on the leadership and in the caucus are focused on the fact that we can launch an investigation, an inquiry into whether there have been high crimes and misdemeanors, and then see where it takes us.
Congressman, of course, we know the president has been tweeting about this. I'm going to read you one tweet from today, and I'm quoting, highly conflicted Robert Mueller would have brought charges if he had anything, but there were no charges to bring. Congressman, are you concerned that essentially that there were no charges to bring, that if the Democrats did not impeach, that means that the president did nothing wrong?
Okay, that statement, which I had not heard before you read it to me, is a 100% lie. That is completely contradicted by what special counsel found and what he enunciated yesterday. What he said was the reason that he didn't bring charges was simply because you don't bring charges against a sitting president. That is a Department of Justice policy rule, which special counsel Mueller thinks is grounded in the Constitution itself. So he was pointing out that all of the factual evidence that he assembled is still there, and that evidence is overwhelming. So, you know, I don't know who dictated that to the president or whether he concocted it himself, but that is completely contradicted by what special counsel Mueller did yesterday. And it's part of this thick fog of propaganda that the president and Attorney General Barr have been spreading across the country ever since the report was released. It's a remarkable thing. They are counting on the American people not reading the report, which recounts multiple episodes of presidential obstruction of justice. And they think that they can just pull the wool over everybody's eyes.
Now, here's the pickle, Congressman. Of course, Senate Republicans are going to have shown no indication that they're willing to impeach Trump. Doesn't that put you on the defensive or doesn't that put them on the defensive if the Democrats are trying to impeach? I mean, is there a strategy there?
Well, the constitutional standard is whether high crimes and misdemeanors akin to treason and bribery have been committed by the president. In the past, obstruction of justice has been a cardinal high crime and misdemeanor. Our judgment is complex for this reason. There is a legal and a political dimension to it. The legal dimension is whether the high crimes and misdemeanors were committed. I think anybody who reads that report, like Republican Congressman Justin Amash, will come back and say that the evidence is simply decisive and overwhelming that the president did commit these offenses. But even if we find that legally high crimes and misdemeanors were committed, we still have the political judgment to make, which the framers proposed in Congress, about whether this is the best course forward for the public interest. Now, I think if there were high crimes and misdemeanors, the presumption is that you do move forward. You know, Speaker Pelosi has been sensitive to the fact that impeachment is a divisive thing. At a moment when President Trump and Russian propaganda have already driven deep wedges within the public, and I know she's very attuned to that, and properly so. But at a certain point, we have to determine whether the impeachment process would be more of an illuminating and unifying experience for the public to get the truth out, because there has been so much propaganda created by Attorney General Barr and then tweeted out by President Trump with his inane mantra of no obstruction, no collusion, when the report demonstrates there's overwhelming evidence of obstruction and at least some evidence of collusive behavior, though not rising to the level of a criminal conspiracy.
Congressman, of course, beyond the Mueller investigation, the president also is under involved in a number of other investigations, about 17, including the Southern District of New York here, looking into the president's finances, an investigation into his Mar-a-Lago properties, and on and on. Is the sheer volume of all of these other investigations, I guess the question here is, are any of these investigations grounds for impeachment, or is it really all about the Mueller report?
Well, the fact of the investigations is not itself grounds for impeachment, because an existing investigation is not a high crime or misdemeanor, but the underlying conduct may very well be. And in fact, what's interesting is the Mueller report is not about the most severe and egregious misconduct. Remember that the president said, you know, as he was making his very public threats against the special counsel and attacks on, you know, the special counsel investigation as a witch hunt and partisan, et cetera, et cetera. He said, if you go into my finances, that's a red line. You know, and he basically threatened to blow the whole thing up at that point. It is the finances, I think, that are the key to the whole corruption of this president and this administration, going back to the money laundering taking place with Russian tycoons, going right into the condos and the office tower. That was, I think, the basis of how he got involved with the Russians, and they figured they had an easy target there. There was not an original criminal conspiracy, simply because the GRU and Vladimir Putin didn't need Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump to perpetrate their attack on American democracy. They used the Trumps in order to do it. I think if you read Volume 1 of the report, you see that they fit the Trumps into their pre-existing design. But the Trumps, of course, you know, threw their arms open and unlocked the doors and opened the windows for them to come on in, and, you know, praised the Russian effort. And, of course, everybody remembers Donald Trump saying, Russia, if you're listening, you know, please get those extra 30,000 emails and get them out there. I mean, that was the basic demeanor of it. And when you read the report, you see how much they... There was not a conflict of interest so much as a convergence of interest between the Trump campaign and the Russian attack on our democracy. But my point is that the whole financial dimension of this, which I think is the key, has not been unearthed yet. Trump is fighting tooth and nail to prevent the documents from being released to Congress. But we are the Article I branch. We are the lawmaking branch of government. The Supreme Court has repeatedly determined that Congress has the fact-finding investigative power as a central and unassailable part of our duties and our powers. And they're going to have to deal with it. And Speaker Pelosi is right. We are winning in court in terms of obtaining all of these documents. But what the documents may indeed show is that there is profound financial corruption at the heart of the Trump operation.
Congressman Jamie Raskin is a Democrat who serves Maryland's 8th District in the House of Representatives. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us.
The pleasure's all mine.
Joining us now to talk about how Capitol Hill has been reacting to Wednesday's remarks by Special Counsel Robert Mueller is Lisa Desjardins, a correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Lisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Oh, thanks, Tanzina.
So did Mueller change any minds on Capitol Hill?
I think his words yesterday will be influential with Democrats, as you heard from Jamie Raskin, they are spending a lot of time thinking about what he said. Republicans who are speaking publicly, which is not a lot of them, frankly, right now, Congress is on its recess. They're saying case closed. They want to move forward. They say this is something to put behind Congress. But for Democrats, the momentum goes the other way.
So I want to talk about something that came up yesterday, particularly when we're looking at Attorney General William Barr's comments last month that the special counsel had insufficient evidence to accuse the president with a crime. In Mueller's comments yesterday, he said, and I'm quoting, "If we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so." Now, for I'm sure a lot of people listening, it sounds like a lot of doublespeak, but these seem to be contradictory statements from Mueller and Barr about whether the president committed a crime. What are they telling us?
I do think we need to watch how Congress deals with the attorney general, because there are some who think he should be impeached for this exact conflict and what he said and what Mr. Mueller said. I think you were right to pull that quote about insufficient evidence. And the president echoed that yesterday. And again, as he spoke with reporters returning off of Air Force One this morning, the president saying there was no obstruction. And in fact, some point saying there was no evidence. In fact, the Mueller report says very, and I actually have my copy of it here, all 443
Fantastic.
Pages. It's right in front of me because I'm dying to talk about it in more detail. And the Mueller report actually, in several cases, says there is substantial evidence that the president obstructed justice. It's just that Mueller made it more clear yesterday that he did not feel he could even consider indicting the president because of Justice Department policy.
I want to talk a little bit about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We just talked a little bit about her with Congressman Raskin. But after Mueller's statement yesterday, Speaker Pelosi said she's still holding off on moving forward with impeachment proceedings, at least for now. Let's take a listen.
But we do want to make such a compelling case, such an ironclad case that even the Republican Senate, which at the time seems to be not an objective jury, will be convinced of the path that we have to take as a country.
Lisa, what's your take on this tactic?
Well, I think that she is essentially having to deal with the question of what is morally right, which some 40 or so members of her caucus say is to move to impeachment now, versus what will work, which is right now, there are not the votes for impeachment in the U.S. Senate. And in fact, that's a very high bar to impeach a president. The House essentially is the prosecutor. Then they would move forward the impeachment trial in the Senate. You need 2/3 of the members present in the Senate. Right now, the Senate is 53 Republicans. So 2/3, if you do all the math, it ends up meaning you need 19 Republicans, or one out of every 3 Republican senators would have to vote to remove this president. So Pelosi is looking at if the House moves an impeachment kind of indictment, so to speak, or articles of impeachment to the Senate, as a potential political suicide. And the president knows this. That's why his message from the White House to reporters like Aryamish Alcindor yesterday was, bring it on. We do want impeachment. So Pelosi is trying to manage this. She sees huge political risks in impeachment right now. And you heard this from Jamie Raskin, too. What they're trying to do is change public opinion. They are hoping that they can bring the public on board the idea of impeaching this president. But right now, the public is not there to the degree to sway Republicans.
Not to sway Republicans. We did see data that shows that there are more Americans today who do support impeachment. And that number is in fact, rising. The question I'm wondering here is also, you know, there are members of the Democratic Party who do want to start impeachment. I don't know if a lot of this is for their own 2020 political campaign benefit, to sort of rally their base, if you will. But how is Pelosi sort of managing both of these sides of the party?
Very carefully. You know, I was speaking to one Democrat, you know, in the past about how Pelosi does manage her party. And this person said she really, when we're in these meetings together, what she's doing is she's watching everyone's expression. She is trying to figure out exactly where people are. And she is kind of afterward talking to them, trying to get them on board where she is. But she is a very good reader of exactly where all the Democrats are. So one thing she's saying to the press, And I ran into her last week, actually, after she returned from the White House, and she and I had a conversation about this. And she was angry at the press because she says, oh, you all are making so much out of what you call a split in the caucus, that, you know, we're, that we've got this impeached now versus not impeached now. She said, that's not true. We're all unified. And she's making a point that those who want to impeach are something like 40 or so of her members. She has 200 other members who are not there yet. The problem for her is that, as you say, the number who want to impeach now is increasing, and it now includes leadership. The chairman of House Oversight, Benny Thompson, yesterday came out and said he is ready to move to impeachment. That's a very strong statement from a core leader of one of the key committees involved in these investigations. So the pressure is going to be on her and on Democrats. But I think for now, at least for the next month or two, they probably will just continue on this path of having investigations. And at the top of that list, they want to talk to Robert Mueller. It's not clear how they will do that, if they will need to subpoena him. They may. Many sources are telling me they may. They're not sure.
They may not get anything from him if they do it.
Right. You know, he has to get his own private attorney now. So it's going to be a little complicated.
Lisa, I want to ask you one more thing before we end the segment here. You did, you're talking a little bit about the Mueller report, and a lot of Republicans are saying case closed. Is the case closed?
No, we haven't even had the case fully opened. I think as a reporter, I would at least like the public to have a chance to see questions answered about that report. That's not to say what its conclusions are or are not, but we haven't had a public session of questions and answers about this report yet.
Do you anticipate that we will, given yesterday's remarks?
I'm hopeful, but I have no idea. I don't know.
Lisa Desjardins is correspondent with PBS NewsHour. Lisa, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Amy Walter here. Next time on a live special from the Green Space at WNYC, we're tackling the Electoral College. As the movement to ditch it in favor of a national popular vote grows, we look at the pros, the cons, and the consequences for such a move. On The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.
When Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico in September 2017, hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans were displaced from their homes. Many of them traveled to the mainland United States in the hopes of finding more stable housing.
El sitio donde yo vivía era campo. Hacía aire natural, fresco.
We lived out in the country. The air was natural, fresh. It was completely quiet, only the sound of roosters. I miss it. I would bring the Puerto Rican flag with me, even to the moon.
That's Kenya Ciuro in a clip from After Maria, a documentary out now on Netflix, directed by Nadia Halgreen. The film tracks the lives of Kenya and two other women who left Puerto Rico for FEMA-funded hotel rooms in the Bronx. Halgreen focuses her story on the weeks before government assistance on those hotel rooms is set to expire, and the women must scramble for an alternative. Since Netflix released the documentary last week, some Puerto Ricans have criticized the decision to focus on those who left the island rather than those who stayed. Joining me now to discuss After Maria and why it's drawing such a strong reaction is Francis Negron Montaner, a filmmaker and professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Thanks for being with us, Francis.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Many, many things to unpack in this film. I saw it yesterday. You saw it. Why is this film getting the reaction that it's getting? Let's start there. And what is it? This is not the only film about Maria.
Not for sure. There's actually over a dozen films about Maria, and quite a few focus on Puerto Ricans leaving Puerto Rico for the United States. I think the criticism falls into three things. One, that it should not be focusing on people that leave Puerto Rico. Two, that it should not be focusing on the people that it does because it makes Puerto Ricans look bad. And three, that it doesn't provide enough context to understand what is going on. I think of those three critiques, the only one that we could discuss with that has some merit is the third one, because the first two, that we can't have a film called after Maria that focuses on people that left Puerto Rico. It's just inconsistent with what happened. Over 100,000 Puerto Ricans left Puerto Rico after Maria.
And in fact, the majority of Puerto Ricans live in the mainland United States.
Correct.
Something that we also have to be clear about.
I mean, right now there's over 2 million more Puerto Ricans living in the United States. So therefore, the experience of diaspora or displacement from Puerto Rico to the United States is a constitutive part of being Puerto Rican. The second one, I think, is even more problematic, which is the idea that the women that are featured in this film somehow make Puerto Ricans look bad because they have limited resources, because they are in a difficult situation. And what happened in Maria was really that Puerto Ricans picked themselves up and so forth. And I do think that that story of people becoming their own first responders in the absence of support from the government is extremely important to tell. However, that does not invalidate a story about people who left because they could not cope with the situation of having been left homeless without other options.
And we also, I mean, we did here on The Takeaway, we did an entire show on the resilience of Puerto Ricans on the island after Hurricane Maria 1 year later, so that those two things don't seem to be so far disconnected. The stereotyping to me was, or the concerns about stereotyping to me felt, and I'm going to use the word classist here, the critiques about this. It's what's interesting to me is how we tend to, in the media and beyond, intellectualize issues. Like when we're talking about Maria, when we're talking about Puerto Rico, we talk about the poverty on the island. This was a clear example to me of what that actually looks like, right? Yeah. These were not women who were coming from money, if you will, or even, you know, well off. I mean, they were very poor on the island, and having to do that here in the States is hard.
And the reality is that close to half of the people of Puerto Rico live under the poverty line. Poverty has become more entrenched and more widespread in Puerto Rico after more than a decade of debt crisis austerity. So in that regard, the women represented and featured in the film are quite representative of a large section of the population.
I think there was another issue here where the women, and I remember watching this and thinking, Puerto Ricans are really diasporic people. I mean, even in the family itself, you see the range of race and hair texture and all these other things. And I'm wondering if that was something that people really understood about this film as well.
Well, I think some of the critics in Puerto Rico, and if you read the threads that are online, I think some people are quite explicit in saying that they don't think these women are representative because they are from a low class and they don't represent Puerto Ricans in the best light, which would be, I guess, in their view, light-skinned, educated people. But of course, those people are much less likely to be in the predicament that the film explores. So I think it's very important to tell the stories of multiple displacements and lack of support.
And this also is raising some issues here, I feel like, about racism within the Puerto Rican community, classism within the Puerto Rican community, that I think a lot of folks have not been as aware of as they may have now that this backlash has sort of appeared.
Absolutely. I think that the critics are actually not American viewers on average. I mean, most of the critics that I've read are Puerto Ricans from Puerto Rico and some from the diaspora. Now, the third critique that some people have articulated is that the film doesn't provide as much context to understand what people are going through. And I think that has some merit in the sense that you could have done more to provide that context and maybe put it a little earlier in the film. So those people that already have stereotypical views about Puerto Ricans don't end up concluding that people are just not doing anything or that they're waiting for the government to do something for them. The reality is that FEMA's job is to support people that are affected by disaster. So this is not an unreasonable expectation, and that Puerto Ricans have received significantly less support than people that have been victims of other disasters throughout the United States.
I'm also thinking After Maria is a film that was directed by a woman, a Puerto Rican woman from New York, which we would call New Yorican. How do you think that is playing into some of this backlash? And again, we're going into some places that I think we haven't gone into in the show. But what does that tell us about the diaspora, mainland Puerto Ricans, quote unquote, versus those who were born, quote unquote, on the island?
I read comments that describe the filmmaker as a foreigner to Puerto Rico. And I think that speaks to long-term tensions between some people in Puerto Rico and how they view the diaspora as foreign to the Puerto Rican experience, culturally alien, often also somehow inflected with African-American culture or Black culture, which means that they're no longer Puerto Ricans, speaking English, which is supposedly not the language of Puerto Ricans. So I think that the perception of the filmmaker as not being a real Puerto Rican also plays into the criticism that this then is not a legitimate perspective. Now, I should say that of the dozens of films that I've seen about after Maria, a number of them have been made not only by New Yorkers, but also by people from other countries, Iran, Brazil, India. So in that regard, I don't think the issue is so much where the person is from, even, but what is the perspective and what is the nuance and complexity that that perspective brings? Because I think also the filmmakers of After Maria is a person from the diaspora. And I think one of the things that she's trying to do with this film is to connect the current wave of migration with prior waves. So if you looked at the entire 20th century, you're going to see that Puerto Ricans have been constituted by these forced migrations in many occasions, on a cyclical or every so often. And that is why we have over 5 million Puerto Ricans in the United States. So I think part of what she's trying to do is like start telling this story of this new migration that's going to come to reconstitute and transform Puerto Rican culture in the diaspora once again.
Frances Negron Muntaner is a filmmaker and professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Thank you so much, Frances.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. It's been a wonderful week. Thank you for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.